from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1996 when a practicing physician turned his operation into a pill mill. Dr. David Proctor had watched as OxyContin was introduced to the market and he saw an opportunity. He realized he could prescribe the pain pills and people would pay maybe $250 every month. Never mind that he might be willing to write the prescription with essentially no basis. This was a business model that practically guaranteed a steady flow of clients. Dr. Proctor saw as many as 80 patients a day, and you might guess what happened next. People were getting addicted to pain pills, OxyContin, and soon, Dr. Proctor's parking lot became a kind of hub for bad behavior, fights, property damage. By 1999, Dr. Proctor lost his medical license after he had gotten into a car accident and suffered multiple injuries. But the now former doctor went on to hire other doctors to continue this lucrative pain pill mill. It was only stopped by a federal investigation several years later. Today on Connections, we're looking at the spread of the heroin problem in our region and our country. So why start with OxyContin? We're about to find out. This past Thursday night, my colleague Michelle Faust hosted Need to Know on WXXI-TV with a focus on heroin and opioid abuse. The numbers are staggering. NPR cites a number of national organizations that show deaths related to heroin have increased fivefold in the past 15 years. Deaths attributed to prescription painkillers have doubled. It is not just Philip Seymour Hoffman, not just celebrities, not just inner cities. And so my colleague Michelle Faust is helping host our show today. It's nice to have you in studio, Michelle.
Thank you.
And on the line with us, our first guest is Sam Quiñones. He's a journalist, a former LA Times reporter, and the author of Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic. Sam, thank you for taking the time for us.
Great to be with you guys. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, and thank you, Sam, for the remarkable work that you've done in this book. And I want to start with where we began this program, the question of Dr. Proctor and what was changing in the 1990s. And a lot of our listeners will say, you know, they understand pain pill addiction and abuse, but there is sort of a thread of connection here. Let's go back to the 90s. What was going on then? And tell us a little bit more about Dr. Proctor.
Sure. Two things were happening, really, of import. One was a major revolution in pain management. There was a pain revolution, essentially, in U.S. medicine that held that we were a country in pain, was not being treated. There was an epidemic of untreated pain, and that we needed to treat that. As it happened, at the same time, insurance companies were cutting back on a variety of ways that had been used to treat pain, a variety of therapies, physical therapy, this kind of thing. Doctors, as they were told that they were now facing an opiate, an epidemic of pain, of untreated pain, were also told that basically the only way really to treat it that an insurance company would go for was through opiate pain pills. A lot of doctors were reluctant, skeptical, but several pain, I would call them crusaders, pain specialists who promoted this idea, along with a drug company in particular that made OxyContin, promoted also studies, what they called studies, that showed, appeared to show, I should say, that these pills, when used for pain, were virtually non-addictive. That was the buzz phrase, virtually non-addictive, or less than 1% of all patients treated with these pills get addicted. And so it kind of calm the fears and skepticism of many doctors, and many doctors began to then prescribe this for all manner of pain, and this includes post-surgery, even down to, you know, a wisdom tooth extraction, that kind of thing, chronic pain, athletic injuries. You saw this opiate revolution really take place in a country where we almost never used opiates for anything. Even terminal cancer patients could die in horrible agony without these pills. Now we were using them for every wisdom tooth that was being extracted. Along with that, now you get lots and lots of hundreds of thousands of legitimate doctors buying into this idea. But along with that, you get some scandalous doctors like Dr. David Proctor, who had his practice in Portsmouth, Ohio, a tiny town on the Ohio River across from Kentucky. And that's really that one town. The reason I focus on that town is because that's where the pill mill was essentially invented, post-OxyContin. That's where you had the beginnings of that business model of a doctor just churning out prescriptions every day by the dozens, if not the hundreds, and people lining up in long lines and people coming from out of county, some frequently then out of state, to get their prescriptions and then go to a pharmacy and get them filled. But all of this starts with this pain revolution that we are currently still certainly living with.
Okay, and so a couple of points there. When it comes to that question on, you know, less than 1%, fewer than 1% of patients would be addicted, et cetera, as you say, a lot of doctors really did buy in, but at what point should we have reasonably realized that addiction is becoming a real problem?
And I mean, I think right from the get-go, the papers that were being promoted as studies, in quotation marks, were hardly that, and were easily available for doctors to read if they'd gone into the journals and found the journals and read them. The truth is, those journals were very difficult to find sometimes. There was one, they called it a study, that promoted this idea, not because the author meant to promote it, but simply because pain specialists adopted it. And it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1980. What ended up happening was doctors didn't have enough time. They took the word of specialists. Specialists were saying, look, we know this now. 3,000 years of history dealing with opiates doesn't matter. We know now that if you use these pills to treat pain, that and pain patients, that they will run almost no risk of addiction. It was kind of a ludicrous idea. I think a lot of people are feeling the hangover of this and feeling like, what was I thinking? Because these pills were then, what ended up happening was there was kind of like almost a fire hose of pills blasted at the country with almost no nuance as to who was getting them and for how many pills at a time and for what reason.
I'm sorry, Michelle. I was just going to say, I'm going back to my own career. In 2001, I was a reporter for the CBS affiliate in Charleston, West Virginia.
Yeah.
And not too far from where all this was happening. And I remember in 2001 watching an anchor on a competing station, a different station, and I'm not going to name names, and look, we were all sort of new to covering this epidemic at the time.
Right.
But there were a lot of questions on, well, how are people abusing these pills? And on the evening news, he said, well, here's a pile of OxyContin pills, of Oxy pills. And he said, in order to bypass the time release effect, you just grind them up and snort it. And everybody's going, wait a second. First of all, why are you demonstrating what that looks like? Second of all, had we reached the stage where by then, this was 2001, had we reached the stage where it had gone beyond people who had pain and were getting easy prescriptions without much vetting and moved into a new drug of abuse, drug of choice?
Yeah, I mean, but here's the thing. I focus in part on Dr. David Proctor, but the truth is that the number of scandalous doctors similar to him were really actually very small in number. This epidemic starts because huge numbers of legitimate, well-meaning, very well-intentioned, and very prepared doctors bought into that idea. It's not so much the people on the fringes, although they are the absolute scandalous stories, you can tell, and there are a good number of them. It's really the way this starts is basically because a lot of doctors buy into the idea that we no longer run a risk of addicting our patients if we use them to treat pain. And, you know, in some cases, in a lot of cases, they were right. People did. People could use these without much risk. The problem is there were a whole bunch of people who they couldn't prescribe them to risk-free, and these people got addicted, and there was a huge amount of collateral damage. But this issue, this topic of opiate pill and heroin addiction is the first in the modern era, since World War II, say, that was not started by the underworld, by drug traffickers or street drug dealers. This was started by modern, legitimate doctors, well-meaning, well-intentioned doctors. There was then on the fringes a whole lot of people because this allowed for a huge, as you said earlier, a huge business model where you could just kind of almost print cash. And so a lot of people got in on that as well. But this is an amazing tale because it doesn't start with your trafficker lurking in the back alley or something.
Right.
You don't have traffickers lurking in back alleys, but you did have a concerted effort by the drug companies pushing for doctors to be prescribing these medications.
Really,
you make that very clear in your
point.
Book.
Exactly. Right. Precisely. The context to all this is that everyone is looking for an opiate, a painkiller that will kill pain but not addict people. They've been searching for this for 50, 60 years. Finally, doctors kind of say, well, maybe the way to do this is not finding some new drug like that, but just finding a new way of administering it, maybe over time release, some kind of time release mechanism. Along comes OxyContin that does precisely that. The pain specialists say, terrific, we found the way to treat pain without getting people addicted. The pill company, Purdue Pharma, which makes OxyContin, released it in 96, picks up on that, of course, and says, look, the pain specialists say this is true. And they begin also then promoting OxyContin, marketing OxyContin as if it were almost an over-the-counter medicine. So they have, they're promoting it to doctors. They're not promoting it to the general public, but nevertheless, the promotion is such that kind of resembles over-the-counter medication. So you're getting, they print up hats with OxyContin. They print up phone pads. They give you trips to Scottsdale in Florida for continuing medical education in which doctors are brought on to say, yes, we need more time-release opiate painkillers, just like OxyContin, basically. They had a fabulous CD called Swing in the Right Direction with OxyContin, and it was a collection of like 10 swing band tunes, you know, Benny Goodman and Count Basie and Woody Herman, that kind of thing. All of this was as a way of breaking down doctors' inhibitions and fears and skepticism with regard to opiate painkillers and convincing them that now was a new day, that we had new technology, new knowledge, and that their patients would not get addicted. And they did a terrific job of convincing doctors of this.
We're talking to Sam Quiñones, a journalist, a former LA Times reporter, and the author of the book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Throughout these 2 hours today, we'll be taking some of your comments and questions, if you have them, at Evan Dawson on Twitter. If you like, you can email the program, and you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. My colleague Michelle Faust is in studio today because it was her, I think, excellent reporting and work that she and the staff did from Need to Know this past Thursday night. And Michelle, as you were putting that report together, I recall some conversations in the newsroom, people saying, well, heroin, I thought, is what you're talking about. Why are we talking about opioids, et cetera? And I think there's still some confusion about just how similar heroin is and how much of a connection it has to OxyContin, opioids.
Well, I will leave part of that conversation for our second hour, so yes, we can talk to the doctors who can actually make the comparison chemically. But my understanding is that chemically, there is not a big difference between different opioid drugs, including heroin. And so what they have the same possibility of being used incorrectly, being abused, and becoming addictive. And that's a situation that you'll have in any case. The difference really is, are you going for a street drug? Or are you getting something that's over the counter? Or are you using illicitly something that you can get from a pharmacist? But really, at the end of the day, the addiction working on your brain works the same way. It's still going to the opioid receptors in the brain. Again, I'll leave that to the doctors,
yes,
to explain a little bit better than I can. But at the end of the day, we're talking about addiction. We're talking about opioids. I thought it was very interesting in the book, Sam, which, by the way, I really appreciate that book. And it gave me some guidance as I've been working on our series on heroin at home. And our listeners can find that at WXXINews.org and just click on heroin at home and see as things are rolling out throughout the month. But there was definitely a clear comparison by the way some of the pharmaceutical drug reps were behaving and the drug trafficking.
Right.
The,
yeah, I focus
sellers.
On, right, exactly. And thank you very much. I appreciate it. I focus on what got me into this story, I should say, is that I had lived many years in Mexico and at the time was working for the LA Times on a series of stories about Mexican drug trafficking in America. I stumbled on a story about a town, a small town that I'd never heard of living in Mexico 10 years, didn't know this town, where everybody in the town was a heroin trafficker in the United States. And they weren't just any heroin trafficker. They had developed a model, a business model. Again, business models are recurring themes when you have drugs that a customer cannot not buy, has to buy every day, several times a day. You can design business models very easily around that customer. These guys had a business model for selling heroin retail like pizza. And the idea was that you would call, you, the addict, would call an operator, and they would circulate these numbers throughout any town that they landed in. And that operator would then dispatch a driver who was tooling around town all 12 hours a day, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., business hours, with his mouth packed with little balloons of tenth of ground doses of heroin. They would then dispatch the driver to the place where the addict was or near where the addict was, usually a parking lot, a Burger King or a Target parking lot of some kind. They'd make the deal there. And this system was just amazing. I thought that they had, you know, done it in one or two towns. No, they're in 17 states. They're from the town of Jalisco in the small state, the Mexican Pacific Coast state of Nayarit. And guys from Jalisco, Nayarit, have taken this system almost nationwide. It's remarkable how well it's worked. Now, at first, they were selling in areas in the early 90s when this system really began to spread. They were selling in areas that did not have growing numbers of addicts. Salt Lake, Portland, Reno, this was prior to the pill revolution. But then they are the reason they're interesting is, first, their system is bizarre and fascinating, I think. I just can't get over it sometimes. But also, they were the first ones in a systematic way to understand and exploit the growing pill market. And they did this. They discovered this when they crossed the Mississippi River in 1998 and landed, one of them in particular, landed in Columbus, Ohio, just as the pain revolution was well underway. Purdue Pharma was promoting OxyContin, almost like over-the-counter medicine, and widespread addiction was just then beginning. The guy who did that, in conversations with other addicts and whatnot, came to understand that these pills were very much like heroin, and that if he only followed the pills, that he would eventually have a pretty decent heroin market. And that's what these guys did. They were the first to do this. They were the first to bring black tar heroin east of the Mississippi River. They landed in Columbus, and from there they began to spread out, like spawn almost, to other parts of the Midwest and the Carolinas, places like that, West Virginia, et cetera. And their story is almost identical. Let's put it this way. There are great parallels between their story and the way Purdue Pharma marketed its drug, in that they're always looking to promote the drug, always looking to stress the convenience of the drug. Purdue Pharma stressed, you don't have to now take six or eight pain pills a day. You only have to take two. These guys were all constantly promoting the idea, we'll bring it to you. You don't have to go down to some Skid Row place or mean-looking drug house. We will drop it off near you. There were startling parallels, and I thought fascinating parallels between these marketing methods. And they kind of dovetail. There's no conspiracy here. There's no Purdue Pharma in this town in Mexico, you know, trying to work together. That's not what I'm saying at all, of course. It's more that coincidentally this happened, and they had similar systems for promoting the drug. And that was really where this pill market first got exploited by heroin theft.
And this is where I think Sam Quinones' book and his explanation starts to turn on a light bulb, at least for me, and I imagine for so many people who read your work, our listeners, because I recall covering the OxyContin problems in Appalachia in 2001, mm-hmm. 2002, and a lot of people were saying, well, okay, but if they can stop this, it probably won't become something else, because the people who are abusing this, they're scared of the stereotypical drug life. They don't want to be in, your term was Skid Row. They don't want to go down to Skid Row. They don't. And
right.
And yet your book explains that these guys were so innovative, they knew that their clientele was different. They were more like delivering pizzas, making you feel safe and reliable. And so when a lot of people were thinking, well, this won't morph, heroin, for example, black tar heroin isn't going to take the place of an OxyContin or move in, people are too scared of that. You seem to paint this picture of a very innovative, frankly, frighteningly innovative group of people
right.
who understood how to reach those possible customers.
Exactly. That's correct. I would say frighteningly innovative. They are very innovative, and they're constantly morphing. They probably have morphed two or three times since my manuscript's been finished. You know, seriously, that's the way the drug world works. It's constantly evolving and changing. But that's right. They figured out, and they also figured out that once a person gets addicted to OxyContin, if that person does not get treatment, that eventually the pills costing what they do, which is usually a dollar a milligram, it's untenable. You cannot sustain that kind of addiction for very long. You're paying $200-$300 a day. Eventually, you will have to switch to heroin. Doesn't matter what at the beginning you thought of needles or in shooting up or anything like that. The addiction will overpower any reluctance, any stigma that went along with it. It's that powerful on the human brain. It is a remarkably powerful thing. And so eventually people will start, if they're smoking it, snorting it, or eventually shooting it, they eventually will switch to heroin, because heroin now, this is the other big change that's important to note. Heroin now is cheaper than it's ever been in the history of that drug, certainly in the modern years, let's say since World War II. That's because all our heroin now comes from Mexico or Colombia, no longer comes from Burma or Turkey or the Asian areas, or certainly it doesn't come from Afghanistan. It comes from really close by, and that means it's a commodity. It's like any commodity. It's affected by how far it has to travel to get to its market, and if it's not very far, as in the case of Mexico, that means the price is much, much lower. And so the comparative price between pills, which are a dollar a milligram, you're talking 150, 200 milligrams a day is what a lot of addicts use, down to 150 bucks a day, 200 bucks a day, down to compared to the Mexican heroin, which is about a full day's supply would probably be 40 to 60 bucks. You can see the differences. And that right there, those two things, the potency of the addiction combined with the price change is what has created this problem. And it's amazing to me that I'm talking to a radio station in upstate New York. I mean, it's just amazing to me where this thing has landed and where all the different Alabama, Vermont, Idaho, it's just rural Oregon. It's just all over the country.
The interesting thing is you make that connection between the pills and then people switching to heroin. It's very clear in one of the studies that I read that actually came from University at Buffalo. It was very clear in the study, 3 out of 4 of all the people in that treatment study had started with pills and then moved to heroin. And it's something
right.
that a lot of people that I spoke to, I spoke with one person who was working under that doctor in Buffalo, person in treatment, and he said it was very clear. He was an alcoholic and he used pills, and he thought that he was not the same as other people using needles. He never switched, but everyone else I spoke to had switched and moved on to heroin.
Exactly, and there's two points that are very interesting, which you bring up, Michelle. The one is that we always talk about whether or not whether illicit drug problems are demand-driven or supply-driven. And in this case, most clearly is a supply-driven problem. You just have so many pills out there, so many people marketing it or blasting it at the population, that and there's so many big bottles of pills hanging around medicine cabinets from surgeries that people never really needed to use. This is another part of this revolution where you give people 60 Vicodin after a surgery when they end up using 4. Well, there's 56 Vicodin hanging around their medicine cabinet. Plus, and at the same time, you've got the pill, which looks, it's like the classic gateway drug. I mean, it looks so believable or dependable. It's got a pharmaceutical marking. The doctors prescribed it. What is the problem? What could possibly be the problem? And the problem is that these are intensely addictive, and if you're not careful and not instructed in their use and not given a limited supply, but instead given 60 when you maybe need really only 4, then that's a recipe, for disaster, and particularly when this is done on a widespread basis all across the country for decades, which is what's happened.
Our guest is Sam Quiñones, a journalist, former LA Times reporter, and author of the book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. I'm Evan Dawson. Michelle Faust, my colleague, is with me for both of these hours today as we look at heroin, its roots as sort of the modern and new epidemic that it is. And in our next hour, we're going to kind of drill down more locally. But we've got a few more minutes with Sam Quiñones. And Sam, I do want to read a listener question. And we always like to look for solutions if we can find them, and I don't think anybody, whether it's a journalist or a doctor or anyone, has all of the answers. But this is sort of illustrates some of the questions or confusion people have. And this comes from Mike. Mike says, which would society rather have, pill addicts who are using measured pharmaceutical doses or people using heroin? And what do you make of just the framing of that question, Sam?
Well, I mean, it assumes that we need to have lots and lots of pill addicts. It's a good question. It's one that's come up before, I think. But I think, I think what we'd rather have is what we had before all this, which is not so many addicts to anything. Because anybody who is addicted to these things, it's like you are anchored to the drug. You cannot function. You cannot go away on vacation without a supply of your drug. You cannot, take a weekend off. You never take a day off from using the drug. That's why I say these are drugs that people, once they're addicted, cannot not use. They have to use it every day. My feeling is that these pills would not have been a problem had they been far more measured, had the specialists who promoted them and the company that promoted them been far, far more measured in what how they should be used and certainly how they marketed them. They should have, it seems to me, not suggested that these be sent home with everybody post-surgery, for example,
yeah,
in large amounts. It should not have been, there's a lot of things that we were very happily using Advil to deal with. I got my wisdom teeth out years ago. I'm pretty sure I got an Advil. I'm quite sure I did not get a pill like Vicodin to deal with this problem. You know, and it's almost so part of our society. We're so afraid of pain. It's almost like we're afraid of living with any kind of discomfort. It goes beyond pain to discomfort. But my feeling is that's the question itself is assuming something that doesn't need to be in existence, which is widespread. This was created. This was not something that grew organically from American society. It was created by marketing of these pills, by claims on their efficacy that were way out of proportion to what was true, and also, frankly, our own as American patients, health patients, our own desire, insistence, in fact, that doctors solve our every problem and our every pain, and we treat our bodies a little bit like one doctor said in the book, like cars, and doctors are car mechanics. Here, doctor, here I am, fix me. And by the way, I'm not really going to participate in any suggestion that maybe I need to change my behavior, my lifestyle choices, stop smoking, walk more, eat better. All of these kinds of things lead at times to chronic pain. So we have there's a lot here. It's an interesting topic because when you're writing about heroin, what I realized as I got into the book is you're really writing about America. It's really a way of talking about America and where America is today. And there's attitudes that we possess as American health patients that brought this on as well.
I think it was really interesting. One of the things that you mention in the book, you highlight a doctor based out of Seattle, Washington, that had a different approach to pain relief and
right,
was basically defunded and people pushed more towards the opioid pain relief. Could you talk a little bit about that clinic and,
sure,
and why it wasn't as popular?
In the 1990s, the opiate revolution is under very, very seriously underway at this point. There is already another opinion on how to treat pain, and it's generally called a multidisciplinary approach. And that's where a chronic pain patient, mostly a chronic pain patient, which was applied to, should have a variety of therapies. It's kind of a widespread physical therapy, swimming, acupuncture, but also marital counseling sometimes they found chronic pain related to strife at home, lack of a job, things like this. It was a kind of a wide panoply of approaches to the same person's chronic pain. That was in full flower really at the University of Washington, kind of the birthplace of pain studies in the United States for many years until this opiate revolution came along. Insurance companies began saying, well, we have these pills, why should we fund acupuncture? Why should we fund occupational therapy? Why should we fund all these different therapies began getting defunded, and the therapy really doesn't work. The treatment doesn't work if you just use three out of the six. They found that you really have to use all of them, and it's a long-term process. At the same time, they were finding patients didn't, you know, once they had a pill, they didn't want to go through all the work because it's a lot of work. You have to be accountable for your own health and your own well-being and your own body. And it's a lot of work to make yourself well again, particularly after you've had maybe some problems or you're overweight or what have you. And so what they ended up finding was the insurance companies began cutting back on funding these therapies. At the same time, patients became more reluctant to participate in them. And so what doctors were really left with was the opiate pain pill. That's the results that we're seeing today.
Before we let you go, Sam, and again, we're talking to author Sam Quiñones, whose book is called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Dorothy is a nurse, and she writes to us on Twitter, we need to minimize the use of narcotics, optimize the use of non-opioids in acute pain management. That's Dorothy's take on all of this. And before I let you go, I want to just ask you, as a journalist, as you said, even since your manuscript hit, you have seen changes in the way sort of the drug market is functioning. And it is always that sort of amorphous thing. I mean, we're never going to be able to perfectly pin it down. But where do we go next here? And what would you leave us with that you want our listeners to consider as we go forward and try to understand this epidemic?
I would say that, as I've said already a couple of times, that part of this lies within ourselves, that we are far too demanding. We feel far too entitled to perfect pain care, and also that we don't spend a lot of time thinking about how our own choices as human beings affect that or don't affect that. And so I think when you go in next time for surgery, ask the doctor, why are you giving me Vicodin or Oxycontin? I know a little bit about it. Can you tell me how I should be using it? Number one. And number two, why am I getting so many? Why am I getting 90 instead of maybe 6? You know, I think part of it is taking being accountable ourselves for this, because as you say, the underworld is morphing in substantial ways. The guys that I write about are still hard at work in all the states that they, you know, so the 17 states that I first found them in, probably another 6 or 8 by now as well. What's changed in the underworld is that they are clearly not the only ones who have figured out the pill market now. Everybody has. The Sinaloa drug cartel from Mexico, your local street dealers, every addict is a potential dealer himself, because you can't have a job for very long when you're addicted, and so you have to sell to support your habit. I mean, all of these things are happening now, and it's happening very fast, and it's more prevalent than ever, and it's more urgent, therefore, that we as American health patients begin to ask questions and demand of ourselves the same accountability that we demand of doctors.
Let me squeeze in one more quick comment, because I think it's the right time for it, as we discuss heroin and opiates these 2 hours. It's a listener who wishes to remain anonymous who emailed me this morning. And she wrote, I feel like we are attacking people who rely on prescription pain medication for legitimate reasons, like myself. I don't know if life would be worth living without the relief I can get. No one wants to need pills, but I don't consider myself an addict. I consider myself a patient. Sam?
Of course not. Yeah, and there are a lot of people like that, and this is the problem. This is exactly right. That listener is exactly right. The problem that those folks face is that because these pills were prescribed with such little care for so long, that it has created collateral damage that now affects them, even though they may need these drugs. There's a lot of people out there who do. They need them probably in lower doses than doctors may think, but whatever the case, there are people like your listener who are out there, and now they are feeling the effects as well. The problem is that for too long, doctors prescribe these things without any real time or paid or spent figuring out whether this patient in particular, this individual standing before me, is a good candidate for these. And so what you get is huge amounts of collateral damage. That listener needs to understand that his pain is lessened, but at the same time, you know, almost 30,000 people are dying of opiate overdoses a year from this stuff. And so I feel that for that person, that's absolutely true. But I think that person needs to get on the bandwagon of, hey, let's really pay attention to who we're prescribing these drugs to, because I need them, and I have a documented record that shows that I need them, but a lot of people don't, and a lot of people are dying because of it.
The book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Sam Quiñones is the journalist and the author of that book, and congratulations on the work. I say that with gratitude, Sam. Thanks for bringing it to our attention, and we appreciate the conversation today.
Oh, my pleasure. It was great talking with you, and good luck with your show.
All right, a short break. We're coming right back as we continue the conversation on understanding what's going on when it comes to heroin, opiates, and more right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, just how big a problem is heroin in the Rochester Finger Lakes region? We'll talk to various experts in their fields, from emergency rooms to the Rochester Drug Court. What percentage of people in treatment in Rochester Drug Court are there for heroin or opiate addictions? The number might surprise you. We'll dig into that and much more, answering your questions next hour.
On the next morning edition, the Greek economy in crisis and why buying a car in China can cost a third more than in the U.S.
I think the government still think that a car is still luxury stuff. So whoever can afford a car, they are rich people. You should pay more tax.
China's consumers and the latest news from Greece and the euro on the next morning edition.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My colleague Michelle Faust is helping co-host the program today. These 2 hours focusing on first the broader issues related to opioids and heroin, and next hour we'll zero in on our region. But as Michelle did such a wonderful job on this important subject on this past Thursday night on Need to Know, which is our weekly news magazine on WXXI-TV, we wanted to broaden that conversation. And our next conversation is with reporter Ben Allen. He's a general assignment reporter for WITF in central Pennsylvania. Michelle.
Hello. So, Ben, are you there?
I am here. Good morning.
Now, Ben is one of the people that I've been speaking with. I've spoken to a lot of reporters across the country that are working on the same issue to try to get some perspective of how, you know, how does New York compare to the rest of the country? You can see some of the reporting that we've already done from Need to Know and from this morning on Morning Edition. You'll find that at WXXINews.org, and just click on the link that says Heroin at Home. That's the name of our series. Now, in Monroe County, the Monroe County Medical Examiner's Office in 2014 examined just under 100 heroin overdose deaths. That was a 70% increase over the prior year. Now, a lot of the reporting that you've done, Ben, has focused on the fact that a lot of times the way that we report on these deaths is not the same from one county to the next. I know that Monroe County, for example, does a lot of the toxicology reports for several of the neighboring counties.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of different issues here. First of all, the first issue is really the most basic issue, which is, you know, how timely is that information? If you don't have the information that you need at a moment's notice, then it can be hard for law enforcement. It can be hard for health professionals that are seeing these overdose victims out in the field. It can be hard for them to actually combat it. In our area, I go to Pittsburgh, where a particularly potent mixing agent, heroin is typically mixed with what's known as a cutting agent. This cutting agent is called fentanyl, and that was mixed with heroin, and that led to 22 deaths in about 2 weeks in Pittsburgh last year. If there is the more complete and more timely information, perhaps it's easier for EMTs to recognize what is actually happening with a patient and change how they actually combat that overdose. I know that when fentanyl is mixed, it usually takes a more intensive effort to bring that person back to life than if it was just heroin and your standard cutting agent. So that's the first issue, is just that timely, more complete, more comprehensive information. But then when you talk about coroners and counties, that's where things get a little bit tricky, because some counties will say that it's simply a multi-drug toxicity, because in most cases, heroin overdose victims do not die just because of heroin. They have other drugs in their system, whether it may be cocaine or marijuana, maybe they have been drinking. So there are other drugs in their system. So there's the question of how do you categorize that? But then there's also the question of, you know, are you going to actually list out all those drugs? A national organization for medical examiners recommends that you do just that. You list out all those drugs, but coroners, citing money issues, citing staffing issues, some even frankly citing, you know, privacy of a family, have decided, you know, I'm not going to list out those drugs on a public death certificate, and I will simply leave it as a multi-drug toxicity. So all of those issues kind of come together to really make this a hard problem to get a precise understanding of. There certainly is that general understanding, but in terms of a precise understanding for something as complex as this, that's really lacking in a lot of areas, really not only in Pennsylvania, not only in the Northeast, but nationwide.
I think this is one of the most important points that can probably be made in these 2 hours that I thought Michelle and her reporting on Thursday night for Need to Know really made sure that they hit that point very, very effectively, which is what Ben just talked about. There is a big difference between if you know anybody in your life who is on heroin. I mean, I can't stress this enough. It's bad enough that drugs are a big enough problem. But when you don't know exactly what you're taking, that is very dangerous. And the fact is, heroin didn't used to be cut with different things. I want to listen to a sound clip. This is from Need to Know this past Thursday night. Michelle talked to Jim Wesley. He is the supervisor of the drug chemistry section for the Monroe County Crime Lab, the Public Safety Lab. And here is Jim Wesley on heroin talking about the way that this has been changing. Let's listen.
If you look at the heroin coming in now to compared to even several years ago, the numbers of what we call decks or the little packages are up an astounding amount. All the heroin 10 years ago just had heroin in it. The heroin we see now a lot of times has caffeine. It has procaine, which is a local anesthetic, but a stimulant on the heart. And it has occasionally fentanyl, which is obviously deadly. And even something like xylazine, which is a horse tranquilizer, is in a few percent of the decks.
I've had conversations with Jim before. Michelle obviously did for the program. And Ben, this strikes me as one of the most important points here, because multi-drug toxicity seems like a catch-all, but what it really partially signals is we don't exactly always know. And if you are buying drugs wherever you're buying them, you might not know what you're getting.
Exactly. Multi-drug toxicity, really, if that's getting listed on a death certificate, from all the reporting that I've done on this and all the research, all the experts that I talk with about this, they say, you know, it simply should not show up on a death certificate. They understand why it does. I've talked with coroners who say, you know, we have limitations. We're already dealing with more overdose cases than we ever have in the past. So we only have so much funding to go around. So, you know, we can't run, extensive tox reports on every single person. Sometimes we have to use circumstantial evidence and can make a determination simply based on that. Sometimes, and I've had people say this to me, sometimes in a small county, in a rural area, even in an urban area sometimes, a family will come in and say, you know, I don't want this to get out. And that is a very real concern for someone that's a coroner. I mean, you can only imagine the trauma that a family of an overdose victim is going through. And it's difficult to say as a person, I want to potentially add more hurt to that situation by branding this person as a heroin overdose victim, knowing the stigma that unfortunately is associated with the drug. So there's so many issues wrapped up in this, and we haven't really even discussed the healthcare side of it, where if healthcare professionals have access to that information on a more consistent and more current basis, potentially, you know, they can bring more people back to life. Now, that doesn't solve the underlying problem, but it at least gives someone a second or a third chance.
You know, I'd really like to take one of the cuts from an interview that you did from one of your stories. Could you tell us a little bit about Miss Emiger?
Yeah, Anthony Perez is his name, but his mom is Stacy Emiger, and Stacy, this is a middle class family in Lancaster County, which is Amish County. Amish country, I should say, here in Pennsylvania. And it's, you hate to follow the cliches or the stereotypes, but it is such a common story right now. A middle-class white family, maybe working class, maybe blue-collar, maybe white-collar. And he first started with pain pills, and it eventually escalated to heroin. And Anthony was addicted for a couple of years, and then unfortunately passed away in March of last year. And I talked to his mom, Stacy, and she kind of details exactly what happened, if you want to play that cut.
It's difficult as anything. You know, I'm not afraid to admit that sometimes at night I go to bed and I'm weeping like a baby. And, you know, there are some times when some things will catch my eye, like a photograph of Anthony, or, you know, something that he may have written to me. And it just strikes me. It's very hard. It's a grief like you'll never know.
And that's Anthony's father, Stephen Mercado. And talking a little bit about just coping with this, I sat with them for just about 2 hours in an interview, just talking about the period leading up to their time with Anthony and then ever since then. This has been more than a year, and they still have, like many families do, they still have everything in the house that was Anthony's. It really is something that they saw coming, but something that you can never prepare yourself for. And it's stories like that really propel me in talking with officials. You know, we see a lot of numbers, and we've talked about numbers and statistics, but there are so many faces behind these numbers, and it's easy to forget that those faces are many times people who made maybe one mistake, and that mistake turned out to be deadly.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. We see the pain that a lot of these family members are dealing with in the interviews that I've done. We're seeing that in some of the stories that I'm reporting as well, that regardless of how the person died, the family is suffering even still. Let's go ahead and get Imgur and her take.
Everyone says it's so bad in our area, it's worse than anybody else. Well, it's bad everywhere. It's just amazing, suddenly, how heroin has just ballooned out of control. And if you don't know how many people are dying from it, how do you know how to combat it?
So exactly.
And that's the,
yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, that's the central question. You know, Stacy Imgur, as she has tried to recover from this tragic loss, she has joined a lot of online support groups. And there, she's kind of referring to, well, everyone says, you know, in my state, in my region, man, this is out of control. And, you know, she started to put it all together and say, it's like this everywhere. This is not a problem unique to New York. It's not a problem unique to Massachusetts. It's not a problem unique to central Pennsylvania. It's a problem that's everywhere. And when you don't have the statistics, when states consistently either do a poor job of collecting accurate, up-to-date statistics or do a poor job of ensuring that those statistics are rigorous, you know, who's going to act? Who's going to help save these kids' lives? Who's going to put in programs in place to make sure that people that want to quit have places to go where they can quit and can do it in a way that is medically safe and in a way that will ensure success in the future.
Reporter Ben Allen is a general assignment reporter with WITF in central Pennsylvania. What's the drive to Rochester? How far are you from us, Ben?
You know, it's a couple hours. It'd be a bit of a hike, but you know,
it's not that far, though. I mean, this is a regional issue. It's all. I think the reason Michelle and I wanted to have you on is how connected we all feel, I think, and how quickly this has connected regions that maybe were, yeah, over state lines a few hours away. And so.
Yeah. You talk about the hop down to Baltimore, and you've got, you know, another hop to Philly, and another hop to Pittsburgh, and another hop to Rochester, and, you know, all of a sudden you're getting, you know, people in that area are getting the same strong drugs that people in urban areas are getting.
Good work on this subject, and thanks for taking the time for us this hour, Ben.
I really appreciate it.
From WITF in central Pennsylvania. And so now you're getting the landscape, sort of the national landscape, and we're moving into a regional focus in this next hour. Michelle Faust and I are going to talk to a number of guests from different parts of our community who are dealing with heroin, opioid addiction, and what we do next. So let's get a short break, and we'll come back and continue the conversation on this subject.